Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And I flew to Sydney, Australia as part of my 7 marathons on 7 continents goal this year. Did I tell you that?
No, you didn't.
My goal is to run a marathon on every continent this year. Mm-hmm. And so I said, where do I go in Australia? And everyone said Sydney is a place for entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. There is no marathon that's going on the day that I'm available, so I'm just gonna, like a madman, run 26.2 miles. Strava will make sure that I'm doing it right. And I've really been looking forward to interviewing you. To be honest, you made it very easy when you said yes. I was prepared to like come back at you and say, here's why you should do it and not. And you said, okay, Andrew, here, I can do it. For those of you who are listening, it's Matt Barry. He is the founder of Freelancer.com. And the reason that I've been looking to say, to have you say yes and is I know your company, I've used your company, I've known you for a long time. I didn't even know like how impressive of a person you are. Like you've got a personality and a look to you, you photograph well, so there are other people who talk about you, but for me, the geeky part is the most interesting. You built out this freelance marketplace. You didn't come in first, but you grew really big, and you understood that this was where the world was going long before the rest of the industry did. And I know because I went back and looked at old articles, so it's not like a thing that you say now retroactively. So I'm curious about how you built up Freelancer as, I was gonna say it's a marketplace for hiring freelancers, but as you told me before we got started, there's so much more to it than that, so we'll talk about what that is. And whether, frankly, would you be bigger if you were not here in Australia, even though it's beautiful to be in Sydney? We'll talk about all that thanks to 2 phenomenal sponsors. The first, we'll host anyone's website, right? It's called HostGator. And the second is a great way to send out email marketing, but they don't want me to call them an email marketing company. It's called ActiveCampaign. I'll tell you and everyone about them in a moment. Matt, good to see you here. Beyond Freelancer.com, let's talk numbers first. Mm-hmm. How big is the marketplace?
So we're the largest in the world by number of users, number of projects posted. So there's 33 million users on the website from all around the world, 247 countries, regions, and territories.
When you say 33 million people, you mean listing themselves or being like me also hiring? Is it a combination of the two?
Combination of the two. You can either post projects or you can work as a freelancer, and we just call them registered users.
Okay.
So it's really every country in the world. We have people in the Vatican, people in Antarctica use the website, and 15 million projects being posted. And you can post any type of work you can possibly think of, you can get done on Freelancer. So things like, you know, build me a website, design for me a logo, right through to astrophysics, aerospace engineering, genetic engineering, biotechnology, manufacturing.
Okay.
NASA uses us, Airbus uses us,
okay.
And so forth. So US Department of Energy.
And the revenue total is how much?
Last calendar year is about $741 million went through the bank accounts in terms of turnover, and $52-53 million in revenue.
To you. And then what about net? That's the part that I wasn't able to find out. What's the net?
We're running at a break-even.
Break-even.
Profitability.
Why aren't you guys bigger? I looked at the market cap. I was so sure. I saw an old article from like 6 years ago saying that you're going to be the first Australian tech billionaire. I was so sure you hit it. I looked at the market cap. It's like $350 million. Why? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a listed company, so the share prices go up, share prices go down. I mean, I do think it's actually incredibly cheap at the moment. That's why, you know, I've been buying stock back.
At
times we've been valued at the sort of multiples that you see in the private, Silicon Valley style venture financings. We're at 50 times revenue at one point when we came onto the markets, but. You know, they go up and down. It really, a lot of the activity on the stock market is really trend following. So something will become hot, cannabis, tech, or what have you, or lithium, and the market will run hard, and then it'll kind of come off again. So I think the price should be high, but at the end of the day, it all comes down to just printing good numbers and getting good results, and the market will kind of adjust itself.
Do you feel like you are public because you're Australian? Do you feel like you're undervalued because it's an Australian company, even though I always thought of you guys as a Silicon Valley company?
No, I don't think that's true.
In fact,
there's times where, we were at $1.1 billion US dollar market capitalization back in 2013, and that was kind of way above, I think, what you'd get in the venture space. Mm-hmm. And not just that, but you also got to remember that we have the advantage of being, when you're listed, it's really, you have this very one class of shares. And so the way that it's kind of interesting, this whole thing about unicorns in the valley, companies over $1 billion market capitalization, I mean, that's all manufactured, right? That's not reality, right? These companies would not get valuations anywhere near that in the listed space. They're manufactured through things like liquidation preference and ratchets. It's kind of interesting. I can talk about a little detail if you want to hear about it. But you know, you find a company that's doing about 20 million in revenue year on year, that's growing about 40%. And if you do a scatter plot of enterprise value to sales by revenue growth rate on publicly listed peers, you'll tend to find there's a linear or somewhat linear relationship for a segment of the curve where if you're growing 40% year on year, you get about 10 times valuation in terms of your enterprise value to sales. So basically you take your revenue, multiply by 10, and so forth. So typically on the public markets, a company doing 20 million a year in revenue, growing 40% year on year, it's about $200 million valuation you'd get on the public markets. VC comes along, says, hey, would you like to be a unicorn? I'll write you a check. I'll give you $100 million. The founder goes, yep, I'd love to be a unicorn.
Okay.
Okay, but there's a catch. The liquidation preference, there's a 2x participating preferred liquidation preference there, which basically means that if the company sells at any point down the line, the valuation of that company is worth $200 million, right? So the first $200 million, goes to the venture capitalist. Sorry, my phone's ringing.
Ah, got it.
So what actually happens is the investors, the founders swap their equity for a call option effectively in the stock. The founder gets their marquee valuation of $1 billion, but the actual fact is when the company sells, it's going to be over $200 million to see a cent. And the investor goes downside limited because he knows in the public markets that's a valuation would achieve. So anyway, the point being is that yes, we could probably get a much higher valuation in the private markets. That would come with some baggage around preferred shares. But you know, I'm pretty happy where we are. You know, we don't need to raise money. And if anything, I'm buying my shares back at the moment. So
here's what I'm going to ask you about. I'm going to ask you a little bit about your background, your childhood. I'm going to ask you a little bit about this sensory networks thing and what you said on the way out the door to find out if it really is what I heard you said. And then about Freelancer, how you launched it, how you built it, why so many acquisitions. Warrior Forum is one of them. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that. Escrow, I did know that, and so on. But I told you before we started that I heard that you were not a great student in school, you were a little mischievous, and then you started to work hard. And you said, who told you that? I found it in my notes here. It's an article. Brian, is it Gansler?
Gansler.
Is he an old friend of yours?
Oh,
know him.
Yeah, he was the guy that topped the entire school.
Super bright guy from what I understand.
I think he's at Harvard or something now. He's like a professor in astrophysics. That guy's a genius. Yeah. That would be talking about high school. I don't know. Like I got the fourth highest scholarship to a pretty well-respected school here in Australia.
Okay.
And I don't know. I think you're talking about 1985 here, so this is a long time ago. It was a different concept in terms of, I think, how I came from an American school in Indonesia.
Okay.
And it was just a little bit. The whole concept, for example, of how you go about studying and so forth was took a little while to kind of grasp. And so I guess in the early years in high school, I didn't do so well, but towards the end, I kind of improved and kind of
got around. The reason I'm asking is, not because I care about the lives of high school kids, it's because I'm trying to get a sense of who you are. And it seems to me that there's a sense, what I was doing as I was reading people's analysis of your childhood was getting a sense of who you are. And it seemed like once the competitive spirit in you latched onto school, you went off. Am I right in armchair, like psychologist approach to your articles?
I don't know, maybe.
So I'll give you a sense of who I was as a kid. Mm-hmm. I sucked at school because none of it made sense to me. They forced me to go into art classes, which I didn't care about. There was music class in high school. I didn't care about it. Give me heavy metal music and don't ask me to analyze it. I'll be happy, but don't make me sit down and try to analyze. What I did love, though, there was a bunch of people who were business people who didn't care about anything, not even manners. They didn't even know what fork or how to wipe their faces while they were eating, but they were creative in this one space and they got to build incredible companies, and I couldn't stop reading about them. Harry Helmsley, if you go walk down New York, you see buildings with Helmsley on it. He wasn't like the nicest looking guy or the guy who knew anything about art. He was the guy who could sit outside of a building and count how many people were walking past it, look at the light bulbs and see how many watts. He was that type of thing I connected with. That's what drew me to entrepreneurship. Do you have anything like that in your childhood? Something that made Matt who he is today and care about the stuff that he cares about today?
Look, I think it came down to a question of you kind of have to go through a mindset, an understanding that you're learning something for the sake of improving yourself. And once you kind of that light bulb goes off that you improve dramatically at anything you're studying, right? Like I think a lot of people when they go to school, they think it's a bit of a chore. They're forced to learn something and they don't really, they can't really connect the dots between making themselves a better version of themselves. And I think that—
But you did.
I think it's probably the light bulb moment was like, understanding that you want to learn this because it makes you a better person.
And was there a class that made you a better person? Besides writing classes, I can't think of many. For me, anyway, I mean.
I think it's a rich tapestry of different things that I think contributed. I can't really... Yeah, there were some moments that were kind of interesting. For example, one of my first classes at Stanford, when I went there, I did a Master's of Electrical Engineering in 1997. And, I didn't actually originally intend on going to Stanford. I actually intended to go do a PhD in robotics at MIT. And I had a reference for the Fulbright Scholarship from Rodney Brooks, who was like the head of the department. But for some bizarre reason, I had the reference and get in. So I kind of got accepted to Stanford, which kind of put me in a bit of a tailspin because I didn't, Stanford, obviously had a great reputation, but, to an Australian, graduate of a bachelor's program, it didn't really have the reputation it has now because the dot-com boom hadn't really happened, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, I'll go, my plan B, I guess I'll go to this university, et cetera.
Stanford was your plan B?
Yeah, it was my plan B.
Okay, right, okay.
Because back then, no one was really talking, at least in Australia, was talking about going and starting a company and being an entrepreneur. It was all about, the pinnacle of technology was basically being a professor. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, well, I've got to be a professor then. Right?
Because you love technology for the sake of technology. And if it meant being a professor is the way to channel that energy, you do it. If it was entrepreneurship, got it, okay.
There was no way, you had these big companies existed, right? The big technology companies existed, but you couldn't really connect the dots between, who created those companies, right? Okay. The light bulb hadn't gone off that it's actually people like you or I that go create these companies. Okay. We just thought they existed, right?
Okay.
So then I went to Stanford, and one of the classes, first class I did there was called Technology Entrepreneurship, and it was 40 people in the class. And the way it worked is one person was the CEO, one person's the CTO, one person's the VP of marketing, one person's the head of sales. And you write a business plan and you pitch basically investors and VCs and entrepreneurs at the end. And every week someone comes in to talk to you about, raising money or negotiation or building a company culture or what have you. And in the very, very first class, actually, this guy called Ken Hawke came in and he said, look, I did this class 4 years ago in 1994 or so. He goes, I was an electrical engineer doing my MBA, and in this class, Yahoo started, Excite started, etc. So, of course, everyone starts paying a bit more attention. And he said, I didn't know what I was going to do. And some guy approached me because everyone wants to know what happens in this class because so many companies have come out of it, real companies come out of it. So a guy said to me, can you do a business plan for me? I'll pay you $1,000. And the guy said, okay, what's it about? And he said, it's for a mail order battery business. And you got to remember back in 1994, everyone had a spare battery for their laptop or a spare battery for their phone before Steve Jobs turned the phone into a hardware subscription. And you can't replace the battery so easily. But and he said, that's kind of boring, right? I want to do something really creative, really, what have you. But by week two, you've got to come up with your idea and lock it in. And he didn't have that locked in, so he said, okay, what I'll do is I'll take the $1,000 from this guy, I'll pay my teammates $100 each, I'll pocket $700 myself, and I'll do this plan. And to cut a long story short, that company, at the end of the class, the guy came to me and said, what do you think about this mail order battery business? He goes, I love it. He's obviously spent a whole quarter on it. And so he was pretty enthusiastic because it was his plan. He said, how about I finance you and you go out and do it for real? How much money do you need? And he said, okay, well, I need 50 grand and I'll give you half the company. And he said, no, wait. Give me 50 grand and I'll give you 25% of the company.
Okay.
And the guy said, no problem. Anyway,
long story. Meaning the student was now, who just worked on this business plan, was being offered money to go and create this mail order battery business.
That's okay. Right. So then that company became 1-800-batteries.com.
Okay.
He walked into the class, and this is the first class I did on campus pretty much. And he said, that company's now worth $75 million. I'm willing to fund four teams here, $250,000 each. And my investor will fund four more teams, $250,000 each, if you want to do the idea for real. Of course, the whole class is like, Jesus Christ, what's going on here?
Okay.
And then that's when things that really started to click about, you could actually go and start these companies yourself. And it's people like you that do it. And if not you, who else is going to do it?
Yeah.
Right? So what is fascinating about that particular class is it's 40 people in my year. And subsequently, that was 1997, subsequently today, 2019, for 40 people in that class, the sum total of market capitalization that's being created from those 40 people alone is over, I think, 200 billion.
Wow.
Right, it's one of the PayPal founders was there.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Which one was in your class?
Ken Howery.
Okay.
He actually came to me and said, you're studying security, can you look at the software? We're for beaming, it's for beaming money to your friends or the Palm Pilot. You can take a look at it. And I said to him, look, there's no securities whatsoever. Aren't you worried about people ripping you off? He said, it's for sharing money with your friends. If they're going to rip you off, they probably shouldn't be your friend. I said, this idea is silly. It's not going to go anywhere. Of course, next thing you know,
yeah,
Confinity merged with X.com, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, and next thing it's PayPal. So, but the...
So that's what got you open to this new way of applying your engineering passion. You, at one point, how soon after did you start Sensory Networks? And it was 2002. How long after?
2001. Graduating? September 12, 2001, we agreed to start the company, which is the day after September 11th, where my friend who was in New York said, I don't want to live here anymore. Can I come back home and start a company with you? That was sometime afterwards. So after I mean, it was an amazing time. Obviously, 97, 98 in Silicon Valley. Things were going crazy. I mean, the Google guys were there. I mean, I started using the Google website because I took pity on them because it was all hosted on the, is it google.stanford.edu, and it loaded a bit faster because it didn't have the banner ads at the top of the page. So all these companies were being created, all these things were happening, and it was just crazy times. So I actually, I worked in the Valley very briefly for, I had an option, which was to go start a company with one of my classmates, a guy called Munjal Shah, who's actually been a very successful entrepreneur in his own right, or go and join this Sure Thing, which is a security company that had been started by these rock stars in cryptography. And so instead of going off with Munjal, I went off and joined this other company. Munjal then went off and raised, I think, $40 million like a month later to do underlay.com, which was aggregated auctioning on Yahoo. And so I joined this company called Verigard, which became Securify. And I think I was the eighth employee. And it sold, I think, was it 9 months later for $64 million, and it had no revenue, no plan, you know, no real clue what it was doing, but and we thought it was too low. And then that was bought by Kroll, which is one of the world's largest investigation intelligence companies, which was very interesting times, the sort of work we did for them. We basically became the cybersecurity division of this massive, you know, private sector CIA. And then around 2000, came back to Australia and decided to work in venture capital very briefly, which I think is a very soul-destroying thing to work in, particularly as a young, idealistic entrepreneur.
I would have thought that would open your eyes up to all kinds of possibilities the way that being in that Stanford class did, because you see all these people come in with nothing and end up with something big.
It's the complete opposite. It's soul-destroying. And the reason why is you meet entrepreneurs every day, and you know, six, seven times a day you might meet some entrepreneurs. You're getting sent 50 business plans, you know, a day. You read through them, you go, this is interesting, that's interesting. They come in, they meet you, and you fund two per year. So you're constantly disappointing entrepreneurs. Every day, you're just meeting people who are really excited about their business, and you don't really want to say no. And as a junior in a venture capital firm, you don't really have the power to do anything. Anyway. The two deals you do a per year have nothing to do with the things that you screen.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, someone rings up and says, I want to do a, you know, do you want to do a co-investment with me in this particular company? So you're just constantly upsetting entrepreneurs. And every time you go to an event, they go, oh, there's the asshole VC that's not going to fund my company,
yeah,
sort of thing,
and didn't
or passed, or, you know, he's stupid because he didn't, you know, understand it.
You spent less than a year there.
Yes.
Sensory Networks. Is it true that on your way out, you said to the VCs, "Good," I think you call them arseholes, which we never use. I don't know what the difference is between that and a-holes, but I think you called them that, and then you also said thanks for the $30 million MBA. Am I right about that?
I don't think I said arseholes to their face. I certainly said many things not to their face. I said, yeah, this is my $30 million MBA, and I'll walk. I mean,
meaning their $30 million,
yes,
they invested in your company.
Yes.
It's like, thanks for giving me the $30 million and also teaching me a lesson about how not to do business again.
In a way, yeah.
Got it. Okay. So yeah. Let's go back then and see in happier times. The idea came from where?
Well, this was a solution looking for a problem, right?
Okay.
So it's completely the wrong way to build a company. So what had happened was I had been approached by my former professor from Sydney University to build a company with him. Well, actually, for funding originally, and he presented, when I was working as a VC, he presented this plan, which is more of a technical plan rather than a business plan. And I said, you need to turn this into a proper business plan, and I'll leave the firm and I'll go help you start this business.
Because? Why?
Because I wanted to build a company rather than...
What was it about this business plan that you liked?
I thought the credentials of the professor were very strong. I mean, it was for audio and video transcoding, so basically connecting up, mm-hmm, you know, the mobile phone network with voice over IP and so forth by producing these network appliances. And you know, you could understand that the voice over IP was being rolled out all across the world at the time, so there's a hot market into that, so
okay,
they could do this efficiently. And so I thought I had some real intellectual property depth,
yeah,
to it, and some good credibility from the investors. So from the founding team. So I. I left and then started this business. And I said naively that I'll raise the money in 6 weeks. And I actually did, which was, through luck and sheer naivety, it kind of happened. And I remember the first day of work, I started work, and one of the guys came up to me and said, hey, there's a conference in Helsinki on audio and video transcoding. You should go. And I just had this moment of reality hit me, which was, I really love Helsinki, but I have absolutely no interest in audio video protocols. Why did I start a company in this space? And I was, do what a lot of entrepreneurs do, which is try and start a company just for the sake of starting a company. Whatever the company is, I just start it, right? It wasn't actually something that I was passionate about, getting out of bed in the morning every day and actually doing. And so then I left fairly quickly and I thought, okay, I've got to do something in a space that I want to do a company. And so I thought, okay, I'll do something in security, network security, because it's kind of studied at Stanford, one of the subjects I studied, and I also worked in that startup that got bought by Kroll. So I thought I'll do that. And then I thought, okay, I want to do chip design, because I'd studied that. I'd never built a chip before, but I kind of wanted to do something in that space. So let's do hardware security and try and build whatever. And so we're kind of working backwards rather than trying to actually figure out was there actually a market for this. So, it was September 12th, 2001, and my friend who was living in New York, Nick DeJong, who used to work for me at Kroll, said, I want to leave New York. And I said, okay, we'll come back and we'll start this company. So the problem was that everything, we ended up producing great technology. It was doing gigabit pattern matching on network traffic, so you could look for viruses and spam and things like that. But it was, we thought we were late to market, but there was no world where there was no gigabit networks deployed, right? So that, the market size was marginal. And just about every failure you could probably have in a company we had, while you had great engineers and you had great technology, product market fit was all wrong. Way too early for the market. We took money from investors that, were not very competent in managing money or managing companies, and created conflict on the first day, pretty much, of work. And it was just a hard slog. And really, through just sheer persistence and willpower, the company survived for a long period of time. In fact, ultimately, it sold to Intel. It was really a problem looking for. A solution looking for a problem rather than actually the way around.
Okay. All right. I want to know about freelancer.com. That's why I invited you here. Let me talk about my first sponsor, and then we'll go into where the idea came from. Mm-hmm. First sponsor, a company called ActiveCampaign. Do you know ActiveCampaign?
No, I don't.
They're freelancers on your network that are actually managing people's ActiveCampaign right now, this second.
Sure they are.
I saw you beam with pride. It is great that's true. It is true.
Yeah.
So here's the thing with ActiveCampaign. They know that people are going to need to do email marketing, but the problem is most people do email marketing like this. They add a bunch of people to their email list and they fire off the same message to everybody. Mm-hmm. Now, for you, for example, somebody who is more likely to look for a freelancing job probably doesn't want to hire someone, probably. Imagine if you could just, based on what sections of the site they were on, you could start sending them different messages. So if they're looking for a freelancer job, you might give them tips on how to get a freelancing job on your platform. If they're on your platform already and they haven't done enough, you might know that they haven't done enough and send them an email message that says, hey, here's how you can get more gigs with us. Here's how you can learn, right? And so on. Message them based on who they are and what they've done on your site. They don't have to fill out a survey to do that. They just have to be on your site. And because you put a single piece of code on your site, ActiveCampaign knows what they're doing, and you then can start writing messages based on who they are. That's what it's about. Usually that tough stuff is really tough. You probably use a high-end software program for that, don't you? Do you even know what you use?
We've rolled our own.
You could talk about like the competitor. It's okay. Do you remember who you use?
Oh, we use Duran.
Oh, that's a Duran? That's the name of a company?
No, we do our own.
Oh, you do your own, of course. Yeah, there you go. That makes your sense. I said, I've never heard of that. Yeah. I thought maybe these guys were like a Marketo or something. Yeah, most big companies do that.
Yeah.
The problem is, for smaller businesses, too expensive, too hard to create your own, manage your own, and so on. ActiveCampaign said, we're going to make it so simple that even the CEO could do it himself. And if he hired a virtual assistant, that virtual assistant will be able to work through a set of processes and make it work. All right, for anyone who's listening to us who wants this goodness, go to activecampaign.com/mixergy. Here's what they're going to get there. Number one, they're going to get to try for free. Free is great. Number two, second month is also going to be free. Number three, they have consultants who will get on two different calls with you and make sure you're using every one of these features. And finally, Matt, you're about ready to switch over, aren't you? Finally, if you're already on your own email system, they will migrate you for free. All you have to do is go to activecampaign.com/mixergy. All right, they don't like that I say email marketing because they do more than email. They do text message, et cetera, but simpler that way. Is it true that the idea for freelancer.com came because you were helping your mom with their website, or is that really marketing?
It's true, actually.
It is.
Yeah. So what happened was, I'd walked out of Sensory, And it's one of those sort of dark moments you have in an entrepreneur's journey where, you know, you've tried really hard to make a company work. And at that point, it was only doing about $2.5 million in revenue, and I'd been running it for about 6 years, and I think we'd sucked down about $30 million in venture capital. And, you know, I was like, what do I do now, right? And, you know, you kind of want to start another business again, because I think, you know, fundamentally you realize as an entrepreneur that you pretty quickly become unemployable, at least for other people. And so you got to start another company. But then I was like, okay, all the people I know that are very good, they're kind of, I've hired them at this previous company, and I feel bad if that hasn't really worked, set everything on fire. So, you know, why would they join me in a second company? And, you know, I was just like, what do I do? And I thought, well, gee, I kind of want to start a company, but just not hire anyone, right? And, you know, obviously VCs have kind of turned against me, you know, because I'd left. And, it came up with those businesses that I think that can consume a venture capitalist's life, having to manage it out and try and figure out how to get an exit. And a lot of VCs just sometimes get consumed by these businesses that just become, you know, just go on forever without actually, you know, be able to, you know, list it or get acquired.
You're saying you didn't like that. You didn't like the idea of as soon as you get on, you have to start thinking about how to get off.
Well, that was actually a big wake up call. Actually, the first time I got a term sheet, it had a clause in there saying that, you know, within 5 years they could appoint a corporate advisor whether or not the company is doing well to sell it, and that's a reality check. But the point was, I hadn't really set the world on fire, and I was like, what do I do now? And so I started just trading stocks, and, you know, it was in the base metal mining was booming. I did pretty well for a while, but at some point I realized I had to kind of start a company, and I thought, okay, maybe I'll just kind of do a few things on the side while I'm doing that. And I told my mum in like 1995, you should build a website. And if she did, she would have been one of the e-commerce pioneers. She kind of imports and wholesales sort of arts, crafts, textiles, glues, paints, and so forth. And so it comes around to 2007, and I said, okay, well, I'll help you build your website. So I helped her build a website. Didn't realize she had 10,000 products with no photos, no descriptions. So I had to, you know.
How was she selling 10,000 products?
People just call up on the phone and they'd ask what you've got, and she'd say, I've got this, and she'd kind of like have this catalog that she kind of photocopied many times
of her things.
Yeah.
And what kind of people would call her, and how would they know?
Just
to shop, find her?
All sorts of shops.
Okay.
Yeah. I have no idea how that business.
Okay. Wow. I see how she's basically not a wholesaler, because crafts.
Yeah.
Okay. And you said, we could get this online. And then you see all the different products that she has, and you say, yeah, I'm not going to, okay.
I helped her build a website. And then at one point in time, obviously there's a lot of data entry involved. At one point I needed to fill in I created a directory of all these shops, and I needed to get someone to fill in, the name of the shop, address of the shop, phone number of the shop, email address, and so forth. And I was trying to get a little brother or sister or a friend of mine to kind of do the work. And I said, I'll pay you $2 per row, and maybe we'll start with 1,000 rows. And so $2,000 of work. You can do it at home on a computer in your own time. And when I was a kid, I would have loved to do a job like that, right? Like, it's like, wow, I can make a bit of money working at home in my own time. And I just couldn't find anyone. I mean, I'd find them and I'd say, this job is boring. Like, I know it's boring. That's why I'm paying you to do the work, and that's why I'm not doing it. They'd tell me, I've got soccer practice, I've got exams, I've got this, all sorts of excuses. I just couldn't find anyone. And after many, many months, I just got frustrated. And I think I typed into the Google data entry online, or cheap data entry, or whatever it was, and I stumbled across this website called Get a Freelancer. And this website, I just confused about what was going on there. Like, it had a lot of activity on it. It looked like Craigslist.
This is what it looks like. I've got a screenshot of it, right?
Yeah, it looks like Craigslist. It's designed with leftover paint from the USS Midway. I mean, look at this. Like, it's just gray.
But look, can I read what this is?
Yeah.
Online pharmacy, a place for dogs, flash intro, simple PHP coding with DB, sign up list calendar. It's like, these are lists for jobs.
Yes.
But it's that kind of confusing. And I get it.
It just looks terrible, right?
Uh-huh. But let's just say this, it is functional. If you know what this is, it's basically like a Craigslist of all these available jobs that you can take on as a freelancer.
Yeah, so I posted a job, not knowing kind of what would happen. Back then you paid $5, which got refunded to you when you kind of pick someone.
It got refunded if you picked someone? Okay.
Yeah. So it's just kind of stop spam. And I posted a job, went to lunch, came back, and I actually forgot that I posted the job.
Yeah.
And then went to my email, and all of a sudden there was 74 emails saying I'll do the job. And I thought, what on earth is going on here? And the first thing I thought was, there is no way this is real, right? I can't find one person to do the job. There can't be 74 people wanting to do this job. And this can't be real people. So I started looking through and I saw people are bidding all these different amounts, and they'd written copy, whatever. I thought, wow, there actually are people there. Then I thought, why? And I looked at the pricing, and I said, $2,000 budget. And I had people bidding $1,500, $400, $300, $200, $100. I thought, why is someone bidding $100 in this job when my budget's $2,000? I can't find anyone to do it for $2,000 locally. Why would someone do it for $100? This can't be real, right? And so I looked through, and yet, sure enough, there were people there, and they're mainly coming from emerging markets. And I said, I should know that. I grew up in Indonesia, right? I should have clicked straight away. But I thought, okay, wow. I didn't really think about wage differentials. And I hired a team in India, and the job was done in, Vietnam. And the job was done in 3 days, and it was perfect. And I didn't have to pay until the job was finished. And I thought to myself, holy crap. I thought, this just changes everything. First of all, invention is the mother of necessity. I mean, here I am not wanting to hire anyone because I was embarrassed to approach them and trying to start a new company. Now I could hire an army of people with a credit card.
Yeah.
And I could start any business I want to. And I thought, gee, this solves all my problems. I can use this site to build anything, right?
You were thinking of it as a customer.
Yes.
Now didn't have to hire people, yes. Didn't have to deal with investors. You could just pay $200 for somebody in India and have them create it, or Vietnam, and have them create anything for you.
That's right.
Yeah.
So then I thought, wow, okay, I should build a business with this, right? What sort of business should I build? And then I thought to myself, I kind of like this website. Why don't I try and copy it, right? Uh-huh. So then I started a business called BidItOut.com.
What was it?
BidItOut.com.
Okay.
You can look it up. There'll be something in the Wayback Machine.
Okay.
And I downloaded a copy of Social Engine, which is kind of like a white label Facebook, and I can program. So I kind of hacked together like a classifieds module for that. And I was hiring freelancers off Get a Freelancer to copy Get a Freelancer.
Okay.
I was getting like design work done and some marketing work and so forth. And after a couple of weeks, I had a rudimentary website that kind of was getting going. And then I did like a back of the envelope sort of calculation of how much money I need to raise to start this business. And back then it was like 2007. So it's still, I was in very much in the mindset, your Series A needs to be $4 or $5 million. You need to hire 20 engineers, et cetera, et cetera. And I then thought, I did a bit of a survey of the space, and there were about a dozen companies, well, hundreds of little tiny companies out there. I mean, every second project on Get a Freelancer was copy Get a Freelancer. Yeah. And in fact, Get a Freelancer was a copy of Scrooplance, which was later on I bought. And I actually found the project in Scrooplance where Get a Freelancer was actually founded, actually.
Huh.
And I basically...
This is your site, right?
Yeah, that's
what's on
there.
Look at this.
Yeah.
Wow. This is your design too and everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at this.
I still look at that site and I think, wow, there's still a few things that look quite nice in terms of
UX. I actually
UX.
Think that it looks better than getafreelancer.com, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so as well.
Yeah.
So then I kind of thought, okay, well, there's 100...
Sorry, I got to ask you something.
Yep.
It says here, .net, 102 different jobs. How many of those are you typing in jobs just to get some things going?
I didn't...
I can't zoom in, but there it is.
I don't know...
Is it real? You actually got people to post jobs on your site?
Yeah, people posting jobs on the site.
How did they find you?
Gee, what were we doing? We were just, I think we were contacting people and Get a Freelancer saying, why don't you come across the BidOut.com as a cleaner interface?
Okay.
I think something like that.
Okay.
I can't remember exactly what we're doing.
Okay.
And then what was happening was I did a bit of a survey of the space, and I figured out, there's hundreds of companies out there. There's about a dozen that kind of had some sort of traction, but hadn't really set the world on fire. And I thought, no one's going to fund me to be number 13. And also, I was really tired. Like, I was broken as an entrepreneur. I spent 6 years trying to make sensory work, and it hadn't really gone that far. So I thought, I just don't have the patience to make the first million in revenue from zero.
Okay.
And that zero to one, that first $1 million in revenue is the hardest $1 million you'll ever make. It can take forever, right? Some people spend their entire lifetimes and still don't get to $1 million in revenue. So I thought, maybe one of these guys will sell to me. Right, so then I reached out to a bunch of them. And I said, interested in selling, and about half a dozen sent me their financials and said, yeah, we're kind of interested. And Get a Freelancer, ironically, was one of them, and it had the best stats of all of the sites I looked at because it had the most traffic, and it had the most traffic because it had the best SEO strategy, and that's exactly how I found it. I just found out for SEO, typed something in. So then I asked how much he wanted, and he wanted less than the $4 million I was planning to raise from scratch. So I thought, wow, I can get a head start. It was doing about $1 million in revenue a year. It had about 500,000 users at the time.
Wow.
And it was about the 5,000th biggest website in the world. And so Cut a very long story short, I bought the company. It took me a long time to get that closed because I didn't have the money. I had to go simultaneously. I had to raise money from somewhere to buy a business that I didn't own.
And for how much?
I think it was about $2.5 million.
And were you looking for just $2.5 million or a little bit more?
No. I didn't raise any money to operate the business other than
just to buy it. My understanding was you did go out to investors and they said, but you're the guy who doesn't like us. Why are we going to give you money? You don't even like the way we do business. Never mind, you don't like us. Am I right?
A little bit worse than that. They wouldn't even pick up the phone for the most part.
Was your reputation really that bad?
Oh, it's a very small community here. Okay. Very, very small. And
why didn't you go back to Silicon Valley? You actually went to Stanford. You had your first job out of school in the Bay Area. Why didn't you just say, you know what? I'll go pick up and go somewhere else. Do you have kids here?
No, not that I know of.
Right, so then what's holding you back here?
I don't know how anyone can start a business in Silicon Valley. It is so hard to hire people. It's so expensive. I have an office in San Francisco
now. But you were looking to hire people.
It's so expensive. Yeah. And the tenure, people don't stay for very long. It's dog eat dog there.
You just didn't want that environment.
I didn't want the environment.
So you said, it's not worth it just to, by the way, the thing that I've been saying lately is my kid now is going to kindergarten. Mm. The Quaker school on Valencia Street, if you make less than $300,000, they'll give you financial aid because you're not making enough money to send your kid to school. $300,000 means you're not rich enough to send your kid to
school. And there's more intravenous drug users than there are high school students.
And so you're saying, look, this is not the way I want it. Actually, that's not off. It's true. Yeah. Once kids hit once they're seven, their parents move them out to East Bay or South Bay. Yeah. I get it. And you're saying, this is not my life. This is not the way that I want to do business. It actually doesn't make sense. So you kept hunting until you found this guy who was an entrepreneur like you. You were trying to raise money from him or get introductions to someone from him?
So what happened was I was trying to do like a management buy-in, right? And when you look up the classic textbooks on management buy-ins in private equity, right, there's a certain structures and it doesn't usually happen with a business that's doing $1 million in revenue. It usually happens with businesses that's doing billions of dollars in revenue.
You borrow money?
Well, you can get private equity to buy out a business and then you come into the management team and you get some stock for being the management team that is incoming. But in those sort of scenarios, you end up with like 5% of the business, right? So... And when you go to a venture capitalist and you say, look, I'm not trying to start a business from scratch. It's already doing $1 million a year. I want to buy it and I want to run it. I want to run it better than the person that's running it now. Yeah. They just can't get their head around that. It's just outside the model, right? And so the investors I did speak to, I had a tough time seeing investors at all, but the ones I did speak to, they just couldn't get their head around it. And so then I thought, I'm a founding team of one, and that's very, very, very tough because psychologically, you've got to be the one that gets up every morning and go, going to do this, right?
Yeah.
You've got all these voices in your head, right? All these voices coming from your friends and your family. When are you going to start a real company? Don't screw it up this time.
Did you really believe that? Like, that was genuinely in your head?
They were telling me outright. My mom was saying, oh, when are you going to get a real job?
Okay. How did you get those voices out of your head? How did you stop paying attention to them and have confidence in yourself after all that?
You just got to put your blinkers on and just go, in my gut. I mean, what I should have mentioned was when the light bulb went off, which was when I posted the job on Get a Freelancer and I had 74 people and the job was perfect and it was done for $100. The first thing I thought to myself was, holy crap, this is amazing. I can build any business with this. The second thought I had was, wow, the Western world's in for a hell of a lot of pain because people are hungry for work and they'll do it a lot cheaper. The third thing I thought was, surely this is a big space. I thought, this is kind of like eBay for jobs. I thought, why hasn't eBay done this, right? And I thought, there's global marketplaces for products that are huge, right? And today, by market capitalization, Amazon, Alibaba, and then somewhere down eBay, surely global marketplace for services is like this big category that no one's looked at. And the problem was that it was kind of always discombobulating thinking about it because when you thought about the numbers, like surely people will go and work online and surely there'll be a marketplace to hire people. And then why hasn't it happened in 2007? It hadn't. There were a bunch of little startups around, but no one had really built a big business at that point in time. And I thought, surely this is going to be massive. Like, massive. Why hasn't anyone seen this before?
And once you see this is going to be that massive and it makes that much sense, you can't pay attention to your cousin or uncle or friend why are you doing it?
And all I focused on was, every time I kind of thought about how big it could be, I just thought, look, I just forget about that. It's too disorientating to think about that. But I thought, it's doing $1 million in revenue. The site looks like crap. Surely I can get $2 million in revenue, right? I fix this, I get to two. And I got to two and I thought, okay, I know I can get to five.
Okay.
Because I can fix these other things and I'll get to five. Then I got to five, and I go, sure, I can get it to 10, right? And now I'm,
what were the easy wins? Well, so let me just say this. So what you ended up doing was you went to someone who was an entrepreneur like you, you talked to him, and he said, I actually see, you guys curse in private a lot. This is Simon Clausen. He founded PC Tools. His quote on why he invested was, fuck it, why don't I just give you the money? Is that right?
Something like that, yeah.
But you know what? I really shouldn't be cursing because I know that people are listening to this in the cars with their kids now, but I get it. So he invested how much money?
He took the 2.5 to buy it.
That's it. And then you went and you bought it from this dude who was, I guess, in a fishing village or something.
Yeah, he was living on set up a fish farm in Vanuatu. A Swedish guy. He thought the GFC was hit and he thought that, the world was, going to collapse. And so he went to, Vanuatu to live and set up a fish farm, which is a staple food for people to eat.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Okay. And I should say, GFC, we don't use that phrase. It's global financial crisis.
Right.
It's like the great recession.
We call it GFC. But, So the way I knew Simon is because Simon built PC Tools and sold that to Symantec, which was one of the first anti-spyware companies. And we were trying to get his software to load onto our chip when I was at Sensory Networks. So I thought, he just sold his company in the consumer space. I'm a founding team of one. I need to put some credibility. Maybe he'll go on my board. I didn't actually register in my head he made a lot of money at all. And in fact, it really surprised me. I'll go and see quite a few investors with him and bring him along. And most of the time, they were just more interested in him being a limited partner in the fund than they were interested in the opportunity. Because everyone like, fish farm, what, Vanuatu? This site looks terrible. What are you talking about? Like management buy-in? And eventually, he just got frustrated and said, I'll just give him the money. And then that's the only money I raised. I raised $2.5 million to buy the website. Didn't raise a cent of capital till IPO for operating the business. So I bootstrapped the whole thing. And then on the day that we IPO'd it, it hit $1.1 billion market capitalization.
Wow.
So,
do you remember where you were the day that it went public?
At the stock market.
Did you do anything afterwards?
Well, I'll tell you what happened, right? So I was there and we were trying to get our bird on the front of the stock exchange because Twitter was IPOing at the same time and they put their bird at the front of, I think it was NYSE. I found the pegs on the outside of the building where we could actually hang a giant banner. And ASX wanted to do it because they wanted to build a tech sector because the ASX, the Australian Securities Exchange, is actually the fourth largest equity capital market in the world. It's the same size as NASDAQ, but it's just in resources, right, rather than tech. So they wanted to start a new sector in tech. And so there was a huge amount of publicity. We'd got a takeover offer at the same time from Recruit that had come in out of Japan, and they bought Indeed.com, and they bought Glassdoor.com, and what have you, and they made an offer for us. And so I said no, I turned that down, it was in the papers, and we were IPOing at the same time, and I was standing up at the podium, and there's a little bell you had to ring, and they said, give it a good ring, because the last person was a little Japanese guy, and he didn't give it a good ring, and I was trying to figure out where the stock price was on the screens behind me, and there's media cameras everywhere, and the issue price is 50 cents, and usually you expect a 15% pop, and so I was kind of looking for 65, 70, 80 cents, whatever the number is. I couldn't see that. I said, where's the share price? And they go, that's the share price. I go, it's like 2.50. I'm doing the math in my head, and I go, oh, that's over $1 billion. And I ripped the cord out of the bell, and I held the cord up, and the media went crazy, and the head of the stock exchange says, this is what new technology does to old technology. And they then framed that, and they sent it to me in a frame with the photo. And from now on, every time someone IPOs the company, they kind of give the cord for the bell in a frame to
really?
Companies.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's actually a good move. So they get to keep it forever and remember the moment.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
What did you do to celebrate privately after that?
Well, the company went and had drinks.
That's everyone in the business.
It's pretty good. It's Justin Bieber moment.
The company my wife works for went public, and I went through the whole process. It really is exciting. It's amazing. You're on the floor, the place where I saw as a kid.
Yeah.
Can't imagine actually getting to ring the bell for real, being the person doing it. Let me talk about my second sponsor and then come back and understand.
Yeah.
What are some of the first changes that you made to the site? It was working. I'm curious, what did you do to change it? But first, I'll talk about my second sponsor. It's a company called HostGator. Let me ask you this. If you were starting today, Robert Matthew Barry, what would you start if I gave you nothing but I said, look, everything's gone, you have no money, you have no reputation, you just have a HostGator hosting company package. What's the one thing that you could launch? Would it be another marketplace?
I like marketplaces, so it probably would be a marketplace.
What's a marketplace that's a good opportunity for someone who's listening to us right now and says, Andrew told me HostGator, I'll go get HostGator. What's a marketplace that you think they should do? What's one that's a good opportunity today?
Oh, I wouldn't tell them the good opportunities, because I'm trying to keep them for myself. But
really? You're busy.
I bought a livestock marketplace the other day.
You did?
Yeah, I bought livestock.com.
And what are they doing?
Sell animals.
Literally?
Yes.
Interesting.
Actually, I had someone looking for $500,000
with a donkey. You personally did it?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I had someone looking to buy $500,000 with donkeys actually a few weeks ago. Okay. It's actually quite funny.
Like, these are real websites?
Yeah.
Where people are buying and selling livestock?
Yeah.
I was actually thinking way simpler. I was saying, you know what, just go find one niche on freelancer.com and create a marketplace of just that one. So imagine we were just talking about ActiveCampaign. Mm-hmm. Imagine we just build a whole website that does nothing but ActiveCampaign management, and that's it. You come to us, and then what we do is farm it out to somebody on freelancer.com until we're big enough that we could hire our own people. You just link it.
That's a good idea.
Model that works?
That's a good idea. And if it gets to $5 million in revenue, maybe I'll buy you.
Really? Mm. Is that the threshold?
About that, yeah.
All right, we've just given people a business model. All right, whether it's that market, oh wait, what's a good platform to run a marketplace on the cheap? You probably know today.
Oh, like off the shelf software, I'm not sure.
You don't know.
But I'm sure you can hire a freelancer on freelancer.com to do it for you.
You're just gonna build it, right?
Yeah,
here's what you say, go copy freelancer.com. I'm sure actually that there's someone who would be able to do that. Whether it's that idea or any other idea, or maybe you already have your website up and running and you're looking for a better hosting company, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. I should say, the biggest benefit of doing that is they're not gonna get a huge savings. Yes, a low price, but it's already a low price with Hostgator. They'll basically be giving me credit for having referred them, which is good for my interviews. Mm. So hostgator.com/Mixergy will get anyone who's listening to us a lower price than usual, and also be a nice, thing to do for me because it'll help me with my sponsors. I really want my sponsors to love me. Mm. I basically want everyone to love me. You don't have that. You don't. You're comfortable with yourself. Yeah. You see, you don't even need to answer it. I see you're comfortable with yourself. All right. What's the first big change that you made to get a freelancer.com?
Well, I remember quite vividly actually, because I had a whole list of things that I thought were not good about the website, mainly around UX and UI. But the one thing that really annoyed me was just the branding, like the whole site. You've got a photo of it here. I mean, it was just gray. It looked like Craigslist. I thought, this just doesn't, the problem with the site, you know, up front here is it just doesn't look like a website that someone in a Western world economy would use, right? It just didn't have any color to it, didn't have any branding to it, and so forth. So I found a web designer friend of mine who actually was in New York at the time, Joel Wasserman. I said to him, look, can you just design like a skin?
Okay.
This, and I'll just kind of do the programming and kind of load it in, and you do the design. I remember the time there were, when I bought the business, it had three Ukrainian developers / customer support people, and one customer support person in the Philippines actually. But I remember that the Ukrainian web developers were telling me, they saw the skin, and they said, "Don't do this. We like the black and white gray sort of colors." You know, all these colors hurts my eyes, I remember them saying. And you know, one of the very first things I did, which is I think is good advice for any entrepreneur, is I just built some instrumentation for like a dashboard for how the site works. And this is hourly, this is daily, this is weekly, this is monthly, and I looked at all the key stats I was interested in. So how many projects are being posted, how many people are signed up. And then today we have 40,000 graphs in real time. I have a whole data science infrastructure team that are taking it to really the next level. But at the time I just kind of had all the stats up there, and then this is kind of before A/B testing, but I was basically just eyeballing changes on graphs as I was trying things. And I remember these Ukrainians were like, no, don't change it to this color version of the website. Just keep it, like, we like it how it is now. And I imagine these guys living in a utilitarian apartment block in some Soviet era building. And we pushed it live and the revenue doubled. Instantly, permanently doubled.
Because when somebody came to the site and it didn't look like a message board, they understood what it was about.
Yeah, it just looked like something that consumers might want to use.
Like, here's the difference between biditout.com and getafreelancer.com. Yep. Biditout at the very top had two clear images. One said, I'm looking for workers, yep. And the other is, I'm looking for work.
Yep.
Like, very clear, you come to the site, you know what it is. It also looked more like I like how everything was categorized by types of project.
Yeah.
I was so sure that what they used was vBulletin to create getafreelancer.com, they didn't. It was custom code.
Completely custom.
That's what I saw. I went to archive to look it up.
Completely custom and written in Ukrainian.
Literally.
Yeah,
wow. Basically. Okay, so that was a big change. What's another big change?
Well, I got rid of I did a bunch of things. I got rid of the $5 posting fee because that required someone to enter a credit card before you actually got a chance to experience the site.
So it's free to post.
It's made it free to post. And then there were some other things that were just stupid, like if you you didn't have to pay the $5 if you picked a new user. So if you picked a new freelancer that had never done a job before,
okay.
you got your five. How did it work again? I think the commission was cheaper or something like that. It was basically an incentive for you to hire a new freelancer. The problem is the new freelancers are the least experienced. right? So so all your brand new users, the tri projects, all your brand new employers are actually picking brand new freelancers and getting bad experiences. And so I got rid of that as well. So there's a bunch of things like that. There's lots of little UI fixes and so forth.
And it was all you just doing that and on your own.
Yeah.
Freelancers for how many years?
So I had a granny flat out the back of my house, and I was by myself. And I remember actually in the first week or so, I kind of was walking down the street to get lunch, and I bumped into a friend of mine who used to help me actually years ago with underage dance parties, and he'd come back from traveling in Europe, and I said, "This is what I'm doing now." He says, "Oh, great! Can I help you out?" And I go, "What do you want?" He goes, "Oh, just give me $20 an hour," and you know, so wow. There's the two of us, and he was doing customer support for 500,000 people, and I was doing the programming, and you know, with the cats, and you know, every time I'd fix something, the revenue got up a little bit, and you know, I'd ask the users what they hated most about the site, or what they wanted most improved, and I'd fix that, and the revenue went up a little bit, and keep watching
you
the graphs.
You just keep asking them.
Yeah.
How?
Email them.
Just send email to individual people, say, yeah, thanks for being on. Was it an automated system or?
No, no.
Just you manually sending a message, yeah, thanks for being on my site. You know what? I remember I went back to look at how things changed. Get a Freelancer also had an affiliate program.
Yes,
right?
It did. Yeah.
You were paying people 50% commissions for sending people over. Was that you or pre-you?
Well, actually, the affiliate program was completely broken. It was paying out 100% of all revenue.
Okay.
And oh god, what were the problems with this? I remember now. It was paying out 100% of revenue, and it was all the wrong way around. So what was happening was we levied the 10% project fee on freelancers, and we have a 3% fee for employers. And what was happening was someone who referred a freelancer who would do a job for someone else, the freelancer's paying the 10% fee, and the affiliate who nominated that freelancer was getting paid the full amount rather than the person who signed up the employer.
Okay.
So it was paying out the wrong party.
Okay.
It should be paying out the employer who actually got the project person in the first place rather than the freelancer who did the job.
The description, I thought it said even that like you get paid on both sides. So I could refer a freelancer, you could refer a company hiring a freelancer, and we would both get paid.
No. It didn't work like that. You only got paid out on the person that you referred. But the problem is,
it just wasn't structured properly.
It wasn't structured properly. It was paying out on the wrong incentives. So, and the other thing is, I had a gold membership, which was at the time I think we paid $9 a month. The commission was zero.
Okay.
Right. And so, 72% of the money going through the site had no commission on it. So it's like, okay, I'll change that.
And then from the beginning, you were thinking roll up.
Yeah. So what I realized was that, well, the light bulb went off in my head was, gee, I was going to start a business from scratch and raise $4 million to start from zero, or for $2.5 million I can buy a website and take out a competitor. And obviously I had all the financials for all the businesses I contacted when I bought Get a Freelancer. So I said to myself, I was going to buy everything, right, and merge all in. And where this really got a big boost was actually I flew to the States, actually, and I met with Gary Swart, who was the CEO of Odesk at the time. And I said, hi, Gary, how are you going? I'm the new guy on the block. I'm from Australia. I've got this company, Get a Freelancer. And he goes, oh, yeah, I saw you bought that. And he goes, well, you know, we'll be the first company that goes public. And when we do, we'll raise $1 billion and we'll acquire you. So I gave him a pat on the head and a pat on the back. And I walked out and I thought, fuck you. I thought, I'm good friends with Gary now. But I said, fuck you. I'll see if I can do this first. So I went, as soon as I had a bit of money, I bought number 8, then I bought number 7, then I bought number 6, then I bought number 5. I actually ended up buying 15 competitors. Of freelancer, and I did that in a way that no one saw it coming. I was lucky with the timing, and I was lucky on the price. I paid an average of 1.5 times revenue, 1.54 times revenue. So I did it super cheap. Everything I've bought has been, managed to buy it at a fairly good price just through patience. And it's actually funny because the only one that went competitive actually was VWorker. Rent-A-Coder, which is an American business that Ian Ippolito started. I think you've interviewed him.
Yeah, I did.
He's a great guy.
He was big in the tech community.
He was. Yeah. And what was funny is after I acquired that, Gary Swart emailed me and said, who's next? And I replied and said, you're next, Gary. I said, you're next, Gary. And he replied, your money is as good as anyone's.
But then, all with cash.
Everything was cash.
No shares in the business.
No shares. Always cash.
Wow.
Every time cash. And actually, I actually had a chance to buy Fiverr at one point. I think it was about $20 million, but I didn't have the money. I thought it was a bit too expensive. And then just before we went public, I called Gary up and said, there's only three of us left, right? Really, in the space. It's Odesk, Elance, and Freelancer. It's us three. And I said, I won't tell you what's happening, but you should, you know, if there's a business consolidation in the space, we're the leader in the mass market, you're the leader in the premium market. Elance is stuck in the middle, and we're eating them from below, and you're taking the high-end jobs away from them. I said, you should probably have a chat with your board about a business consolidation, because if it makes most sense for the two of us to combine at some point rather than anyone with Elance. And he went off and he had his chat with the board. The board said, well, Matt's having the same conversation with Elance he's having with you. So if you don't hurry up and buy something, this whole roll-up plan of yours, Gary, is not going to work. And that spawned the merger of Elance and Odesk into Upwork. They decided to do that rather than engage with me. And you know what actually happened was I'd taken the company public, and my market capitalization was 1.1 billion US, so I had the capacity to do so with equity, or potentially do a fundraising on the public markets and do it. So that they merged and they became Upwork. And
I remember I interviewed them just before that happened.
Yeah. So I almost got everyone. Almost got everyone.
Two people got away. Fiverr. What do you think of Fiverr today? They're going to
They've executed extremely well.
Really?
Yeah, I think they're probably one of the best operators.
Why? What do you think is they're doing so well?
They're just good at execution. It's a good site where people can actually build their brand on the site. I think they've done a very good job of doing that. You know, there's some problems, I think, with the way the business model works. And we've tried doing sort of like the kind of click to buy sort of thing, and it's been a bit problematic. But I think they're good operators.
What's the problem with the click to buy?
Well, let's say I want to get a logo done, right? I've got to browse through all these different designers and all these portfolios, so I have to figure out, you know, what to do. Well, with us, you post a project, you post a contest, you can pay $10. Uh-huh. How much of a victim of his own success this contest side of our site is. The other day, my friend wanted to get some business cards. We're down at the Grand Prix, and he met a race car driver, and he handed him a business card saying, race car driver / you know, inventor or something. Rather.
Okay.
So my friend goes, I want a business card like this. It says, you know, philosopher / entrepreneur or something. So I said, no problem. So I got my phone out. I just went to the Freelancer app, and I posted a contest, for $10. I had 400 designs for business cards for $10. I like this, I don't like this, change this, change that, whatever like that. It's unbelievable. And the quality is exceptional. For $10, I mean, nowhere else in the world is as liquid as we are for jobs. Yeah. 82% of jobs get bid on within 60 seconds, and you post a contest for $10, you get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people submitting entries. So I just think that, you know, that's a superior way of actually getting any visual work done, as opposed to kind of browsing through hundreds and hundreds of different people's portfolios and so forth, and trying to click through and figure out, you know, is this person right for me or that person right for me?
You know, I get why you bought Escrow. I also interviewed the founder of Escrow. Now that I think about it, I knew there was a connection there. That one makes sense. Mm-hmm. The part that I don't fully, the other parts of your business I don't fully understand. Like, why Warrior Forum?
Yeah, so we bought that, I think 2012, was it? You know, at the time there were seven categories of work that I thought if you win in, you win everything, right? Mm-hmm. So web design, we're the leader in the world for web design. That we've done out of 15 million projects, we've done 5 or 6 million web design projects. Nowhere else is as liquid as freelancer.com for getting websites built. And then, you know, graphic design, where we're a major player, but it's quite heavily fragmented. Copywriting, you know, data entry, mobile phone app development, number one for mobile phone app development. There's nowhere else in the world as liquid as we are for mobile phone app development. And internet marketing. So I thought—
Really?
Yeah.
And meaning so, what?
Like SEO, you know, email marketing.
Oh, got it. Know. So finding somebody to manage my email software. Yeah. Got it. All right. So you were thinking
link building, all that sort of stuff. So then I thought, okay, an opportunity came up for Warrior Forum, and so I thought, you know, maybe that's a way we can kind of get all the internet marketers. There's 1.3 million internet marketers. They've got, you know, forums we can talk about. You know, if anything happened in internet marketing, it's on Warrior Forum, and all the people are there, and all the affiliates are there. And you can go launch your product, and you can use those, you know, million internet marketers to go sell your product for you. So that's where we bought that.
Yeah. And you know, I don't see your name on there at all. I had no idea this happened until I met someone earlier today.
Right.
And then there's what was the other business? The freight business?
Freightlancer.
Why Freightlancer?
So the mission of Freelancer is to power the world's entrepreneurs in commerce. And, you know, effectively we're building Amazon on a shoestring budget. So we've got the global marketplace for services being freelancer.com, where you can get things built. You've got escrow.com, where you can sell things and get them paid for. And we deal with the most complex and the sale of the most complex and most expensive assets in the world. So we sell boats, cars, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, diamonds, You know, there's a space station potentially going up in 2021 that's doing tickets for $10 million a seat. We're taking deposits for that now. Shipping containers and stuff.
On escrow, because you hold on to the money until the deal goes
through. That's right.
Okay.
If you buy or sell anything online, you should only do it through escrow.com, because we're the most secure payment system in the world from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in trust, which is a legal construct. So if you want to buy, you know, some diamonds from overseas, well, how are you going to do it? Right? Yeah, do you send the money first? Do you wait to send the diamonds? Why? Because they're fake. How's that work? Instead, you send them to us. We put them in escrow or in trust. Then the goods ship. Then you can inspect them, and then we can release the funds when you're happy. So it's a phenomenal way to actually buy and sell things that are expensive or complicated or valuable. So we have, you know, labor in France.com. We have payments with escrow.com, and we have freight, because many of these things you need to ship physically, right?
The things that are being bought and sold using escrow.com.
Yeah, for example.
Okay.
For example, plus we can now layer on 33 million freelancers to help you do metro point-to-point delivery. So the main market at the moment for Freightlancer is sort of mining, construction, industrial. So we ship things like 1,600-ton cranes, bulldozers, you know, mining equipment and construction equipment and so forth. But we've now layered on top of that 33 million freelancers. I mean, Uber's only got 2 million drivers. 2 million, right? We've got 33 million freelancers, probably most of them will drive, right? So we have a phenomenal network for getting things point to point. So that's kind of what we're doing now. Is Freightlancer is actually an enterprise version of Freelancer. So we're actually even loading the whole website now on top of the Freelancer API, and it'll be driven through the marketplace.
So, and you're thinking some of the freelancers are actually going to be doing driving freight?
Yeah, of course.
Because they're just looking to make money anyway.
Correct, yeah.
You know what? It's interesting, actually. I asked someone in preparation for, I'm going to interview the founder of Airtasker. In preparation for having him here, I talked to someone who worked in a similar business. And he said, well, the big question is, why would somebody do that instead of just drive an Uber or something? And you're seeing the same thing in your space, that it's just another freelancing gig. And all right. I'm wondering why you're doing this interview with me. I talked to Rob Bishop. I don't know if you know him. He's a guy who runs Joycar. You know him? You know
the business? I've heard of the business, yeah.
I asked him, he said, Andrew, you should know all the people who are working with you, understand what's the one thing. Why are they doing this? Why are they buying from you? Why are they doing interviews and so on? So I want to know from you, why did you say yes to doing an interview?
Oh, you asked.
That was it.
Like, basically.
Is there like what's in it for you for doing this?
I don't know.
Really? We'll you just said yes.
Maybe someone will use one of my sites.
That's it.
Yeah.
All right. So you know what? That's the way I pitched it to you. I said, all the people in my audience, all entrepreneurs, they should be using you. All right, another random question.
Yep.
Why cats? You mentioned a cat here in this interview. I read old articles with a reference to cats. What is it with cats?
It's a joke. I used to have some cats.
But no more?
No. My girlfriend stole two of them.
That's it?
Yeah.
All right. Also, here's another thing. Your girlfriends are staying in your life. They seem to like do interviews about you. They're not upset at you. What is this?
That interview was years ago, the one you're referring to, I think.
The Sydney Morning Herald.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
That interview's from like 2012?
2012.
Yeah.
Great interview though. In depth, a lot of stuff. Still on the Hummer?
Yeah.
You do? What do you do for fun?
I don't get much spare time. I occasionally write things. I've written a few essays that got quite popular on the Australian economy or politics or have you. Yeah.
You're not going hunting or anything or?
No, no hunting.
Australians don't go hunting. I don't go hunting.
No hunting.
I held a gun once. I didn't like it. That's it. Just work all day.
Well, like it's a 24-hour, 7-day business, right?
Okay.
So, you know, occasionally weekend socialize or whatever, but basically work.
You're looking forward to retiring one day and maybe just do nothing for a bit? Go fishing village?
I mean, that'd be my idea of hell. I had a good think about it when I had a takeover offer. You know, every 2 days, the price is going up by $100 million. And at some point, Simon said, what do you want to do? You want to get a banker and maybe try and auction it off? And I have this friend of mine who, he's the most frustrating person because he hasn't had a job for about a decade. He's got a job now, but he didn't have a job for about a decade. And he used to ring me up on a Tuesday morning and I'd be like walking to a meeting or what have you. And he would say, what are you doing? I said, I'm just walking to a meeting. And he says, well, it's Tennis Tuesday. I've got two girls in the car. I've got two girls in the car. I've got some tennis rackets in the back. How about you come play mixed doubles? I say, it's 11:30 on a Tuesday morning. I can't play tennis now. Anyway, Thursday I come along, I get a phone call. What are you doing? I was like, I'm at work. It's like, it's Tennis Thursday. Why don't we come play tennis? So because he's obviously doesn't have a job, he's living in his mansion down in Point Piper or whatever. Yeah. Like he was just, he was just ringing up his friends constantly saying, hey, come on, like, let's do something, because he was bored all day, right? And I thought, I would get really, really bored really, really quickly.
You couldn't do tennis Tuesday and tennis Thursday. Oh. You just do tennis once and that's it.
Yeah, if that.
All right, Airtasker is going to be here later today. What do you think of their business? In person.
Yeah. Services. I actually was negotiated by them actually.
Did I say Eric? Tim Fung. Sorry.
Yeah. So yeah, a long time ago when they were doing like 200K of revenue, he wanted I think $13 million for it, and I said too expensive. Look, they've taken a certain model. I mean, I think there's natural problems with their particular model. I mean, they're in Australia and they're trying to launch in London. Trying to go city by city. They're a local jobs sort of marketplace. The problem with that is that there's no global liquidity with local jobs. So let's say we want to start a business like this from day one. And this is a business like TaskRabbit, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I looked at buying TaskRabbit. I had the financials and I turned it down. But let's get going. What do you want to do? Okay, we do plumbing, we could do pest control, we could do carpentry, dog walking. Let's do dog walking. Okay, we think maybe the jobs are good, there's liquidity there. So you're marketing in, say, San Francisco for dogs, and you're doing marketing for dog walkers, and you're hoping that, you know, you build a bit of liquidity, right? You do that, you got some dogs, you got some dog walkers, they're walking each other. Then you're like, okay, where do I go next? Do I go to plumbing in San Francisco and hope that there's some plumbers that have some dogs, maybe there's an adjacency there or whatever, or maybe dogs like plumbing, I don't know. Or then you go, okay, I want to go to Los Angeles, right? But all the dog walkers in San Francisco don't help the dogs in Los Angeles and vice versa, right? So you've got all these little pockets of liquidity everywhere, but no global liquidity. On freelancer.com, someone can sign up and work for anyone anywhere in the world. It's online. Likewise, you can hire someone anywhere in the world. So there's been lots of businesses that tried doing this, and you've literally got to boil the ocean to make it work. So TaskRabbit's sucked down $60 million of venture capital and was doing it, spending about $4 million per city. And I think they only ended up with like 35,000 freelancers when I looked at them, and that was it, right? Because you just have all these little pockets of liquidity. The average job size is a lot smaller. So the average job size for TaskRabbit at least was $80.
And there's no repeat business usually, from what I understand?
It's hard because you've got disintermediation because someone's physically meeting someone in person and then they kind of want to be paid cash. So the average job size is $80 instead of $205 because it basically correlates to the minimum wage in the US times by 8 hours worth of work. So you'd hire someone to, you know, be a party staffer or... Yeah, the number one job on TaskRabbit was collect my laundry, and the number two job was wait for the cable guy.
Really?
Yeah. So
I thought it was assemble my IKEA furniture. No.
No, no. So at least the time I looked at them. So the issue is that there's small jobs. There's a lot of disintermediation because the person's actually met the person physically, and the next time they're not going to go to the marketplace.
You go directly
call them up and pay them cash in hand, sort of thing. Local jobs workers want to be paid cash in hand, right? Because they don't want to pay sales taxes or what have you, and they just want to put it in their pocket. And there's also a lot of pressure to pay someone in cash when they're there because you don't want to be fiddling around the app. The guy's like, come on, you know, keep paying me, I want to go, kind of whatever. And you're kind of, it's kind of a stressful situation sometimes. You've got this big, you know, truck driver or what have you, kind of wanting to be paid. So it's problematic. It'd be interesting to see where they go.
Do you think they're doing well? Is it possible that they're doing $100 million in transactions a year now?
That's what
the Financial Review said.
Maybe. I they're private, so you don't see those are the numbers. Mm. I know that they raised a whole bunch of money from...
$67 million. Again, Financial Review, June 2018 as well.
Yeah, they got it from Channel 7, a lot of it, in advertising credit. And I think I told Tim when he bought it, I would have given him twice the valuation if he'd take Financial Advertising Credit.
So it's not even cash, it's advertising.
I don't think all of it was cash. Some of it, I think, was cash. So I think the rest of it was an advertising credit, I think. And I think I was spending about $1 million, I think, was it a month on My Kitchen Rules, which is like a reality TV show for cooking. And, you know, obviously where you're pumping that sort of money into the TV, you get a return until the money runs out. So you just hope at the end of the day that you can get to the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow by making sure that every dollar you spend, you make a dollar back. It can be kind of tough to do that with that sort of approach. But yeah, we'll see.
I like the analysis of it. All right, what's next for you? Who are you buying? Did you buy my company yet? We're sitting here and something's happening. Just more acquisitions?
I bought 23 of them. I think about 15 or so have been directed as a freelancer.
I'm going to livestock.com right now.
Yeah, see what you're, it's pretty
you're
small.
Buying this personally. Why didn't you do this as part of a freelancer?
Oh, because all my engineers are busy. I didn't want to distract them. I was a bit too embarrassed to tell them I bought it.
And you're just running it. You've got a guy who does this?
Oh, yeah. I've got this phenomenal service actually on Freelancer now. We've got like a service which is called Technical Copilot, which is like a project manager. And they act like a technical co-founder for you.
I had no idea. Really?
Yeah, it's incredible. So it's literally just gone live in the last number of months.
Wait, is this a freelancer who does this or your company?
No, our staff. So what they do is they will talk to you. They'll figure out what you want to, your dreams and aspirations. They'll write up technical specs and they'll they'll build a virtual office for you and they'll manage the whole project. And so I've just got a technical co-pilot kind of building this for me, and they're going, finding staff, they're getting people to manage the listings, make sure there's no spam on the site, finding developers, what have you. And it just acts like a technical co-founder.
Look at this. I can buy a bull in Texas, Champions yes. Valley, right on your website. There's a picture of the bull and the people who, like, with the award that they won. I just made the thing go away. Come on. It's the iPad. I love it, but sometimes things just go away. You saw it go away. I had it on the screen.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Wow, congratulations. Mm. All right. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
No cats now?
No cats.
No plans on getting cats because of
no,
girlfriend?
No plans.
All right.
No
Better plans. To have the girlfriend than the cat. All right. It's freelancer.com or warriorforum.com or livestock.com or so many other websites. I'm glad that I asked you. Thanks for being here. And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, if you decide to create your own marketplace, bring it to hostgator.com/mixergy. And if you want email marketing done right, go to activecampaign.com/mixergy. So glad that you were able to come here. We're going to get your car back.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You bet.